Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. We talk to seafarer, musician and cowboy Jim Carr. Kieran Devaney meets taxidermist Jerry Lundy in Tubber Curry and sees a gannet up close. Larry Butler recalls an adventure sailing from Carlingford to the Isle of Man. And we'll have those winners of copies of a new CD celebrating Gay Lynn's 60th anniversary, Baugeen Islamy. First, though, on this week's edition of Seascapes, we met up with Commodore John Leach of Irish Water Safety a few weeks ago in Dromineer at the Mirror Dinghy World Championships. We asked John if every schoolchild in the country should be taught how to swim as part of the curriculum.
Yes, Marcus, we'd have very, very strong views on it. It took us quite a number of years. It took us till 2003 to actually manage to get the Department of Education to recognise our primary aquatics water safety programme. But regrettably, it's a bit like the physical education, they weren't doing anything mandatory when it comes to physical. Other countries, you know, it is actually mandatory, but in Ireland, physical education isn't, and of course, the swimming and life saving isn't either. We would love it if it was mandatory. We have only, I think it is 520 or 30 schools that have taken it up since we started in 2003. There are just over 3,300 schools. So there's a lot of schools haven't taken it up, where the teachers seem to think that, you know, maths and geography and English and Irish is far more important than saving somebody's life. So we have very, very strong views as an organisation on it. We do have a lot of school teachers within our ranks of our volunteers, who of course ensure it goes into the schools. But I mean, it's got three modules in the classroom, which the teacher can deliver themselves, where they learn about all the various threats around the, you know, the farm, rivers, canals, drains, lakes, the beach. Learn about the flags. Learn about cold shock, hypothermia. What you do, you know, when you go to these water courses to enjoy them. And then they do simple life-saving techniques like throwing the ring buoy, using the branch of a tree, using a towel, throwing a milk container with a little water in it, with a lid on it, as a personal flotation device for somebody in distress. You know, using your voice, having to wade out possibly, but never obviously going into the water unless you're a trained lifesaver with Irish Water Safety. So, yeah, we would love to see it become mandatory, because we wouldn't have had all these tragic drownings had those people undergone some form of water safety training. And that's what's crucial. Education is crucial to people's safety. And we'd be very, very keen to see the schools teach water safety. And then when they've done the three modules in the schools, then there's eight modules in the pool. So by the time the child leaves primary school, they can swim and they can actually do a wading rescue. They can actually do the simple tread water if they ever get into trouble. But more importantly, they know how to stay out of trouble. And unfortunately, the drownings we've had over the last 2 weeks, which were the greatest number really in terms of swimming since 1976, the really, really good summer we had. 1995 was a bad summer, but 1976 was the last time we had quite so many drownings.
Commodore John Leach of Irish Water Safety, and you can read more on their website, which is www.iws.ie. Next here on Seascapes to a man who served as bosun on the Jeannie Johnston and the Bounty. We met up with Jim Carr a few months ago in the Northwest. Jim is a musician, a seafarer and a bosun aboard tall ships, and we wondered how he became involved with them in the first place.
Except for the sail training vessels, which are used for everything from university kids to kids at risk. And I worked for a company called Ocean Classroom. We had three vessels going, and one was for university programs. I ran the one for the at-risk kids. We would take the kids for 8 months at a time, and we'd be going down to the Caribbean, down to South America. And it was a life-changing experience for the kids. Most of the kids that I had worked with, they're either working or are going to universities part-time, or they're going to universities full-time and working part-time. I still keep in touch with them. It's one of those things where when you're gone for that long on a ship, you become like a surrogate parent, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. What brought you out on the water first?
I just always wanted to do it, and I was working as a cowboy, and I went back up to New England where I was playing music, and I happened to go to Woods Hole, and there was this little topsail schooner sitting there, and I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna have to learn to do that. So I was older when I started it, but I started off as a deckhand, you know, and worked 1980, I think it was. Yeah, would have been 80. And that, and then I worked my way up to captain. And I ran programs on the Grand Banks for dory fishing. So we took kids and we trained them in how to use the dories, how to set lines. We ended up with about 1,800 foot of trawl in each dory, and the kids had to go out and set the trawls twice a day. And then we would take that back into Gloucester. Anything we caught, we'll take it into Gloucester and we give it to the food kitchens. So it was getting the kids ready for a whole community thing, you know, and the idea that you have to give something, which was very, very important to them and in their development. Well, we would use all of the physical skills that were needed to run the ship and would use those to teach transferable skills that the kids could then take ashore with them, you know, like a work ethic, presentation skills, teamwork, dedication to the ship, because the ship's number one. You look after the ship first, then you look after your shipmates, and then you look after yourself. But if everybody's doing that, everything's taken care of. And, you don't expect kids to become bosuns or to become able seamen or even want to do it for a long time. But it's by using the ship as a platform that you can teach all the other skills that are necessary for life ashore. And then you have to teach them, how are these skills transferable? It's one of those things where when you come ashore, you really have to be conscious of the fact that you better not take your knife with you, because you walk into a bar or into a restaurant and people are going to look at you. Here comes these strange people, and look at them, they've got knives and marlin spikes hanging off their belts, and it just becomes part of your stock and trade. When you get up in the morning, that's what you put on, because that's your tools.
Now, you're wearing the Jeannie Johnson baseball hat and top.
Yeah.
She's in a bit of a sad state, isn't she? And you spent some very happy times aboard her.
I spent a lot of happy times, met a tremendous number of really nice people. And she was a good ship to sail. She wasn't the fastest ship in the world, but she was never meant to be the fastest ship in the world. We took her all around Europe, around England, Scotland, Wales, around Ireland. And she was an honest ship. You know, if you did your job, she'd do her job. But I have no idea what the politics were. But after we come back the last time from Spain, we tied her up in Dublin. And I don't think there's been any work done on her since, you know, which is a crying shame to have that finer ship sitting there and basically just rotten, dying, you know. It's not just, I think, about letting them know about the traditions. A lot of these traditions are going to die. And you can see that on some of the maritime cadets that come out. And they would come out with us sometimes. And they really had no clue about any of the traditions of seamanship. But they were smart enough to realize, you know what, this may not be used on every ship today, but this is important, because it's a whole attitude that you have. When you go to sea, the Dombrody sitting down there, I don't think they ever should have put engines in her. They should have used a tug to take her out, because she was built to sail. Now she's sitting in there starting to rot too. The Asgard at the bottom of the Bay of Biscay, you know, which is another mystery to me. And the Jeannie Johnson sitting in Dublin. And what are they doing? They're putting Irish kids onto foreign ships for sail training, when we could do the whole thing here. Not only that, but even if you're working with kids at risk, it's cheaper to put a kid onto a tall ship for 8 months or a year and let them come off there with skills rather than putting them into Lusk or Trinity House or someplace, you know. Where all they're getting is they're being overseen and that's it. I just don't understand that, what's the word for it, that attitude. People in government have. It's almost like, well, if you brought these things in and you got the ideas set up and going, does that mean that we've been doing it wrong for the past 40 years? No, we can't let that happen, you know. You know, we would have bands sometimes. We would have a clean up on a Sunday. The whole ship was stripped down, everything was spotless and put away. But then we'd sit around and play music. And I might have been the only one with an instrument. Everybody else had spoons or pots and pans. And it was just a really good, very innocent kind of a time. Well, they're all special because you put 100% of yourself into it every time that you're going out. But I enjoyed the big gaff rig schooners because they were fast. They were sexy. And there was an awful lot of work on them that had to be done constantly all the time. And especially if you're taking kids for sail training. If you don't have something for the kids to do, and it better be a real job, no dummy missions. It's something that's important to the boat that has to be done right there and then. And that's about the best thing for it. Probably I enjoyed the longer trips, the 8 month trips, because you got to know everybody a whole lot better. You got to know the ship well, and you could see the kids developing. By the end of the 8 months, hopefully they'd have been able to run the ship. And you would just stand back and make sure that they didn't wreck her, you know.
Jim Carr, cowboy, musician, and seafarer. Next to our intrepid Kieran Devaney, known to the kings of Tory and Coney Island, he's on land this week as he meets a master of the art of taxidermy, Jerry Lundy.
The lonely call of the male corncrake. But is it a real corncrake?
They're a pair of bones out of a sheep. Rib bones that I put little nicks in, and when you rasp the two of them together in a nice slow motion, you get this exact sound of the call of the male corncrake, like this.
Jerry Lundy is a man who can literally talk to the birds. And his knowledge of island seabirds is legendary. But Jerry is much more than a bird watcher. He's one of the last remaining taxidermists in Ireland, and his workshop, behind his house in Tubbercurry off the old N17 road to Galway, is, to excuse a pun, stuffed full of his work.
The most important seabird I have here is the gannet, and the gannet is one of the most wonderful fishermen of all times. And I've seen them myself on some of the islands off the coast of Ireland, particularly on the Great Salty Islands off Wexford. It has a wingspan of 6 foot. It's a huge wingspan. But when they dive into the sea, they close their wings, power dive right down into the sea and collect their fish.
What about this bird here, a cormorant?
The cormorant, yeah. Another great fisherman. Now, they will come inland. And I've seen on a local lake out here in the Ox Mountains, Loch Talt, you see the cormorant sitting on some of the trees, waiting for a fish, a very unusual fish in Loch Talt called the Arctic Char. Our friend here, the cormorant, would be very, very partial to a few Arctic Char. Now, the bird over here I have in a little glass case is another very, very important seabird. It's called the Little Auk. And the Little Auk only come into land, into the cliffs and the shore to breed. They spend the rest of their life out at sea. They feed between the waves and swim over the waves and fly between the waves to feed. And as you know, the great auk is now extinct. This little auk's first cousin, the great auk, and I think the only Irish specimen is in Trinity College in Dublin. So I'm very proud to have this little specimen here of the little auk. What I have here is another wonderful seabird, and this is the chough. A member of the crow family, for example, would be related to the magpie, the jackdaw, and the raven. It's possibly the only one of that family that lives entirely on the rocks and on the coastline. They feed mainly on the sea cliffs and along the seashore. And they have a call very, very similar to the jackdaw. It goes like, ducka, ducka. But an unusual bird, and not many people would ever see a chough.
And in his own way, Jerry Lundy is helping to rewrite the history of our Irish seabirds.
This particular barnacle goose was ringed in East Greenland on the 16th of July in 1961. It was recovered in Lissadell in County Sligo on the 14th of January 1979. That left the goose 18 years old. And up until that goose was found in Lissadell in 1979, people thought the barnacle goose would live for maybe 10 or 12 years. And that particular goose was 18 years old. We estimated that from where it was ringed in East Greenland to Lissadell and back again, it would have travelled in its lifetime something like 500,000 miles.
Can you make the noise of the barnacle goose?
They have a very deep sound. It's like honk, 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 honk. It's hard enough to make, but when geese are on the wing, it's a deep sound like honk, 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 honk. Two-thirds of the world population of the barnacle goose winter in Lissadell. And they use that as a feeding grounds, the goose fields in Lissadell, and to roost then they fly out to Inishmurry Island and spend the night in Inishmurry Island where there's no fear of foxes or any other predation, and then they come back into Lissadell to feed and to graze. I do fish, yeah, salmon, trout, pike, perch, some sea fish like the sea bass, herrings, mackerel, you get the odd lobster, the odd crab, that kind of thing.
The taxidermist, Jerry Lundy, talking to Kieran Devaney for Seascapes with assistance from Trevor Sweeney. Next, to Larry Butler from Dundalk, who has this account of a voyage in the mid-80s featuring Port St. Mary on the Isle of Man. It was the June bank holiday weekend, time for Carlingford Sailing Club's annual race to Port St. Mary on the Isle of Man. We would normally set sail on the Friday night at about 11 and return on the Monday. I was sailing a Fastnet 34 with a crew of five, but we'd be returning a day earlier on Sunday as the owner had to attend a wedding on the Monday. We had a very uneventful yet pleasant sail over and arrived in Port St. Mary early on Saturday morning. With some of the crews travelling to Douglas on the steam railway and others visiting the local hostelries in Port St. Mary to sample the local brew, we took it nice and easy. As we were sailing on Sunday evening, I and another member of the crew volunteered not to imbibe during the day and take the boat out on the first watch. The weather forecast gave a southeasterly wind of force 4 to 5 with showers, which was a good wind for a fast passage with a moderate sea. I'd normally wear a life jacket, but on this occasion before departure, I clipped on a safety harness as well, much to the amusement of the other tipsy boat crews who were making fun of me about belts and braces. Our crew went below and I took the first watch until midnight. This was in the 80s and pre all the fancy navigational aids such as GPS and chart plotters, so I had to stay on the wheel and steer by compass with my safety harness clipped onto the boat. I was enjoying the fast pace of the boat and did not feel the time pass until about 11:45, and it was then time to alert my replacement as it was near his watch. It was customary in our boat for your replacement to come up for 10 minutes to acclimatise himself and get used to the darkness. He'd just arrived in the cockpit wearing his life jacket and had closed the hatch when all hell broke loose. Suddenly out of the darkness, a mass of water, which seemed to come from nowhere and reach halfway up the mast, hit the boat. It came from the windward side, knocking the boat flat with its 40-foot mast down in the water. All I can remember was the rush and roar of water and being swept overboard out across the rail until the lanyard on the safety harness jerked tight and stopped me travelling any further. To this day, I cannot accurately describe how I managed to get back on the boat. But after what felt like an eternity, the boat started to right itself, and I was swept back inboard over the railing I'd grabbed. I immediately looked around for the other crew member, but he was gone out into the dark water. As the boat began to sail away by itself, with the wind filling its sails, I shouted, "Man overboard!" and struggled to bring the boat about and back on a reciprocal course to begin a search. The rest of the crew began to appear from below deck, dazed and in various states of undress, not knowing what caused the knockdown, but assuming that we'd been hit by another vessel. I started the engine and began a search pattern as we calculated our position and radioed a pan-pan alert to the Coast Guards. We took stock of our situation. Here we were, halfway across the Irish Sea, in the middle of the night in pitch darkness, with no visibility and a man overboard. Also, all our MOB gear had been washed away. I continued to search all the time, thinking, how can we tell his wife and children that we'd lost him? When suddenly we thought we heard a shout, we cut the engine and we heard it again. We grabbed a spotlight and began scanning about. But with the reflection of the rain and the wave action, it was useless and was just blinding us. We had now been searching for nearly half an hour and time was running out fast. Then out of desperation, more than design, the owner of the boat grabbed a heavy torch of the type with the heavy square battery. He turned it on and threw it out into the water. There was sufficient buoyancy to keep it afloat, and the battery weight ensured that the beam shot straight up, cutting into the night sky above the waves like a World War II searchlight. Suddenly we heard a shout from somewhere out in the darkness. "I see it! I see it!" We shouted instructions to him to try and make his way to the light as we turned in that direction. I'll never forget the sight of his face as we came upon him clutching the light under his chin in the water. After a struggle, we got him in on board, took him below, wrapped him in blankets, and put him in a bunk with another crew member to give him warmth. We then cancelled our alert to the Coast Guards and proceeded on our journey to Carlingford. The light proved to be the most simple and effective nighttime life-saving device, and without it, we would not have found him and saved his life. I stayed on the wheel for the rest of the trip back to Carlingford, trying to make sense out of what had caused the massive wave. Over the following few weeks, after many discussions among ourselves and other sailors, there was only one possible theory that seemed to make sense. There had, over the years in the 1980s, been many reported incidents involving fishing trawlers and submarines around the south and east coasts of Ireland. On checking our position of the incident on the chart, we discovered that we'd been sailing through the middle of a submarine exercise area. So, we can only conclude that we must have been close to one of these monsters surfacing, causing a massive wave, or blowing her ballast tanks, causing this massive rush of water. Oh, and by the way, he did make the wedding after all. Larry Butler from Dundalk and his account of a close encounter in the Irish Sea. Now on Seascapes to the winners of those CDs of Bodgeen Islamy, who correctly answered that Gay Lynn are celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. And the winners are Teresa O'Sullivan of Carrick on Shore, Mary Stevenson of Lucan, Anne Morrison of Lewisburg in County Mayo, and Oliver O'Hanlon of Sunday's Well in Cork. Let's hear a track from that Bodgeen Islamy CD, issued by Gay Lynn. It features many of the singles brought out by the label between 1968 and 1980. This is MacMurrough from Wexford with Cúan Baile na Cuairte.
Is the torn from the daughter again.
Mother with Cuan Balia na Cuarta, and that takes me back to the early 70s. Cruinniún na Mbord in Kinvara has been held each year since 1979, and this year it's in its 35th year. Cruinniú is unique for carrying on the tradition of transporting turf from Carraro to Kinvara under calico sail in hookers 150 years old, owned by the same families 5 to 6 generations later. They will land their cargo of turf on Kinvara Pier on Saturday next at 1600 hours, that's Saturday the 17th, and on Sunday the 18th, it's Family Day, with entertainment for all ages. The main hooker race gets off at 1500 hours. The weekend features a spectacle of traditional sailing in all classes of traditional wooden boats. And, as Mick Brogan says, it's not to be missed by anyone interested in our maritime heritage. Next Friday night here on Seascapes, we'll be hearing from Captain Dermot Gray, master of the Grainne Whale, on a life at sea and around our remarkable coastline with the Commissioners of Irish Lights. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.